Welcome everyone joining us here tonight on the Kings County Radio Club's Technical Question and Answer Net. I am Roy, AC2GS. I will be your net control operator for this informal net. I will be your host, and Bob, KD2NVB, will be my co-host on this exploration into amateur radio technology. The purpose of this net is to provide a platform for discussion and to offer our answers, as well as promote a conversation among all participants of this net. The club maintains an archive of these technical nets on its web pages. We also offer original articles and reviews on many topics covered during these technical nets. We also publish technical puzzles for our participants to ponder and as a starting off point to discuss important technical concepts. Tonight's TechNet puzzle is posted on our club website. The link can be found on the front page of our website in our orange colored type, but if you would like a simple URL to find it, just type into your browser puzzle.kc2rc.com. Also, we will be offering a streaming service for those who cannot receive our repeater signal. Just point your browser to stream.kc2rc.com. This net is scheduled for the second and fourth Wednesdays of each month. All of this information can also be found on our club website, which is www.kc2rc.com. Members as well as non-members are welcome to participate, although we do appreciate it when our fellow hams join our club. An application is always available on our club's website. No question is too simple, no question is dumb. All wisdom begins with the asking of questions. If you have a question, it deserves to be answered. Our format tonight will be to ask for participants to check in only if they have questions or comments for this technical net. Please give us your name, your call sign, whether you have a question or a comment. This net will then address each question in order. I will try to provide a cogent answer, and Bob, KD2NVB, will join in as well. If any other listener has any further facts or opinions, they will be free to break in with the word comment, and when recognized, offer their knowledge or experiences to us all. If anyone has any questions or any suggestions for future topics of interest, please let us know either here on the technical net or you can use our email address, which is tech@kc2rc.com. And now I would like to introduce my co-host for this net, Bob, KD2NVB. Good evening, Bob.
Good evening, Roy. Good evening, everybody out there. This is Bob, KD2NVB. Hope we have a nice, productive net tonight. And Back to you, Roy.
Yes, indeed, Bob. I hope we have some participants tonight. I wasn't quite sure if we were going to have this particular episode. We're unfortunately not going to be able to have our next regularly scheduled episode September 8th because of the Jewish holidays. So after tonight, our next scheduled technical net will be September 22nd. But I'm hoping that people have come back from their summer little vacations. They've wandered away, and we could use their participation. So, once again, I am AC2GS. This is the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. If you have any questions, topics, or comments that you would like to make for this technical net, please hit that push-to-talk button. Give me your first name and your call sign. Well, it looks like the summer doldrums are continuing. Don't know what to tell you. Bob, I think if we don't have any participation other than the two of us, I think we're going to just kind of call it a really, really shortened, practically non-existent episode and just move the next slot up to September 22nd. But I'll give the people out there one more chance. If you're out there and you have a topic for discussion, a comment about some technical aspect of our hobby, or if you have a question, please hit that push-to-talk button. Give me your first name and your call sign.
N2HH.
I have a quick little question. It's really just a confirmation of what I think I know the answer is about getting COVID tested. Back to you.
Okay, Bob. Also, HUH, Andy, was there. Andy, do you have any comments or questions or topics tonight?
Normally, I could dream something up, but I'd like to check in, say hello, and maybe make a comment, but not at the moment. So take the other question first.
Okay, so, Bob, you wanted to ask me something.
Roy, I just bounce this off of you. I think it's pretty self-explanatory. I'm visiting my, as you know, I'm visiting my aunt and uncle, and they're both like 87 years old, and I had a gig every Saturday night that I took off the entire month of August because it was a crowded, unmasked event for a precaution, and hope you're hearing me, because I'm hearing a lot of weird beeps on my radio. Might be my bad microphone connection. Now it's okay. And anyway, I just want to get tested before I jump on the train Monday morning, and I figure tomorrow's a good time for that. I figure I'll just get a, you know, the quickie and the PCR, just get both of them. So, does that sound good to you? Or should I do it, like, even more closer to Monday? Back to you.
Well, it depends upon how quickly you could get the results. If you can get the results quickly, probably the later you do it, the better. So, because there's always that chance that you might become infected between now and then. But you know, it's sort of belt and suspenders. The closer it gets to the time that you're going to go there, the less likely that that's going to happen. But all things being equal, strategically, it sort of depends upon when you get the results. If it's same day results, then you're probably safest if you do it the day before you go, I guess.
Yeah, I'll check. I'll make sure that the City MD around the corner from me, I'll see if they're open on Sunday. Yeah, because I will do the, the rapid. And they're supposed to give you that within, you know, half an hour or something. And I heard some opinion of some expert on the radio saying, in some ways that's more important than the other one just because it comes so promptly, even though it's less accurate. So, and I'd get the other one, I guess, a few days later. They usually get to me within about 4 days or something. I did one 2 weeks ago for the same reason, but I figured I could do another one. Okay, so I'll do that. If they're open on Sunday, I'll do it on Sunday. Back to you.
Okay, very good. You know, unfortunately, I can understand that people are getting cross-eyed. One day they're being told to wear masks, the next day they're told not to wear masks, and to wear masks, and all kinds of fun stuff. We're still not out of the hole quite yet, but things look better. I was looking at the curve for Florida, and, you know, it's not like I'm a statistician, but I really don't trust that curve. If you've looked at statistical curves for, I was looking at the number of deaths, and it had a rather precipitous drop. Usually, if you look at other statistical analysis of different geographic locations new deaths, you notice there's an almost bell-shaped curve. It's not as asymmetrical. So I'm willing to bet anything that the guys in Florida are fudging the numbers at this point.
Wouldn't be entirely surprised. Yeah.
Okay, well, once again, this is AC2GS. My name is Roy, and this is the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. We're here on the second and fourth Wednesdays of each month. And with the exception of next September 8th, it's a religious holiday, so unfortunately, we're going to be on hiatus for that. But we'll be back on the 22nd of September. That's the fourth Wednesday of the month. If anyone has any questions tonight or topics or comments, please give me your call sign and your first name.
Real quick, Roy.
Yeah, sure.
Roy, Sandy. I was going to say that I just tuned to the 10-meter band and then down to 11. And I can hear some of the accents from Georgia or wherever and Florida. But as I was tuning through 10 meters, I heard nobody. So I guess guys just don't make it a habit of, operators don't make it a habit of going across the 10-meter band for propagation. I would imagine that it's just not something they do. Unless, during a peak cycle, maybe they do, but not right now. But they're very disappointing when I hear a lot of stations on the 11-meter band, but nothing on 10 meters.
Well, I could understand, but are you sure that their geographic location matches their accent? I find that for some bizarre reason, there's a lot of people with Caribbean accents that are local, that are on this 11 meters, and a smattering of guys that sound like they were brought up in the South, but judging by the amplitude of their signal, they're only about 5 or 6 miles away from me. So are you sure that these 11-meter gentlemen are using their illegal linear amps and operating far southern to us?
It could be that. I'm not an expert, but I remember in the old days I used to tell them, okay, well, give me a phone call. I'll check my caller ID, and when you call me, I won't pick up the phone, but I just want to see the long distance phone number show up, because I didn't believe they were from where they were saying they were from, just as you're saying. So that's what I used to do in the good old days, or at least a good 30 years ago. I want them to prove it, or make a collect call and then see if I get one of these operators. You have a phone call from Florida. Do you accept the charges and all that sort of thing? So anyway, that was a semi technical question, I guess, for tonight, and I just couldn't really tell the difference. But very good. I'll keep my ears open for that.
I mean, one of the annoying aspects of 11 meters is no one was really taught to ID themselves, so they either have a weird handle that they call it, make up a name. They don't give you a legitimate identifier, so there's no way of checking their location. Usually they don't even bother to tell you locations. They tell you local locations. But there's this guy, Trinitron, 13 or 14, and he'll talk about being in Coney Island, but they're very local with geographic locations that they usually give. So I haven't yet to kind of hear guys, not that I listen a great deal to 11 meters, but hear them on 11 meters and talk about being in different states. It's just usually different locations in Brooklyn for the most part, and the signals are rather massively strong. I don't really tune in to the weak ones, so maybe I'm missing those.
Yeah, well, I know I've heard some legitimate ones in the past, but I can't be sure for tonight. I didn't pay enough close enough attention. All right, and I found a sealed lead acid battery, and I charged it. And I put a nice heavy load on it, and it only ran for 3 seconds, and then I popped it open and noticed that the cells were low, and I had some electrolyte from another battery that I had drained that had damaged leaky cells, so I had some electrolyte that I poured into this battery and charged it up, and it ran the same load for about a minute, so I guess it does have some good capacity now. But I would think that the damage was already done. If somebody was running a battery that was low in electrolyte, they've probably already done the damage, but I could be wrong. There's always exceptions. You can never be sure how long it was run like that, but usually that's not something that happens right away. And there's no leaks in it. This one has no leaks, so it actually has life now, or capacity, should we say. Other than that, what do you think? Do you think the damage should have probably already been done to that battery, or I just got lucky that it kind of brought it back to life?
Yeah, I think you just got lucky with that. Be thankful for small favors in the universe.
I say, okay, very good. I didn't do anything else technical at all today, so we'll leave it at that. I'll give it back to you and talk it to you soon. Take it light. This is Handy Andy, N2HOH.
Okay, very good. Once again, this is AC2GS. Name is Roy. This is supposed to be the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. If anyone out there has any technical questions or topics for discussion or comments, please hit that push to talk button and give me your call sign and your first name.
Boris William, Alpha Charlie 2, Zulu Victor.
Hello, William. Welcome back. Do you have any comments or questions tonight?
I wondered if you would be able to discuss grid squares and where they actually came from, and where are they really latitude, longitude, or is this something else? So I ran into that trying to register something. They wanted my grid square, so I looked it up, but seemed like that's something I didn't know anything about really that much. So could you talk a little about that?
Sure. Grid squares are arbitrary identifiers of your geographic location. They're ultimately based upon your latitude and your longitude. There's a lot of conversion software and websites that do the conversion where you can type in your latitude and longitude, and it will give you a series of identifiers which narrow your grid further and further and further. If you take a look at your QRZ page, they take your mail address as your location, and you'll see in around here it's not uncommon to have a capital FN 30 grid square identifier, but then it adds lowercase letters to identify your location in a smaller and smaller set of grids within it. So it's an arbitrary, agreed upon designation. There are other ways that people designate locations. For a time, I think there was some weird thing that if you gave a particular algorithm your latitude and longitude, it gave you two unique words that put together gives you a grid reference. But the one that amateur radio uses is the standard one seen in QRZ and a bunch of other. There are other grid references. There are other area numbers based on arbitrary arrangements of maps where the same way that area numbers for the FCC, that if you were located in New England, your number was 1. So, you know, if you had a license, it would be KD1 something. And if it was in New York and New Jersey, it would be KD2. So a lot of grid references tend to be arbitrary. But I think what you're alluding to is the standardized one based on latitude and longitude.
Grid squares are all the same size, or do you think they change to get smaller as they go north?
I'm not 100% sure. I would assume that they are because they're mapped on a spherical surface, which can confuse and distort. So probably they're more related to degrees of latitude and longitude than to surface area. So they probably have a larger surface area towards the equator than they do towards the polar caps.
Well, this is kind of wondering about. So they're obviously not exactly square.
Well, no, but that's because you're mapping this not on a cube. You're mapping this on a circle. So, you know, it's the old line about squaring the circle.
I don't know much about that old lie. It seems that the squaring of the circle argument was trying to figure out more about pi and to come up with the length of a square that was exactly the circumference of the circle, I thought.
Well, actually, it has more to do with geometry. Back, you know, we kind of think of math almost always, if not simple multiplication, division, addition, subtraction, we think of it more of algebra. Algebra is only about 1,000 years old. The word itself originates from the Arabic. The Greeks used geometry, so they literally meant calculating a circle and a calculating a square and a circle. It did have to do with pi, but the problem was that because pi is a transcendental number, you can't do it. So it's a impossible task. But nevertheless, yeah, I was being a little bit poetic. It's simply that you need to have some kind of grid reference that can be mapped onto a spherical surface, and that's why latitude and longitude is the way it is, because it's a sphere, it's a circular, it's a it's an angular graph as opposed to a Cartesian graph.
Okay, thanks, Roy. I think I got it. I appreciate your explanation. Let's see if anybody else has any questions. Back to net control.
Okay, once again, this is AC2GS, and this is the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. If you have any questions or comments or topics, or you want to talk about the previous subject, please hit that push-to-talk button. Give me your first name and your call sign.
K2NVP with a quick question about squaring a circle.
Yes, certainly, Bob.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember. Squaring the circle, is the idea of a square that's exactly the same area as a circle? Is that what it is? Back to you.
Yeah, it's the same area. That's the trick. The idea is constructing a square with the same exact area as a given circle, using geometry.
So you can get real close, you just can't get exact, right?
Yeah, that's the problem. Because of the nature of pi is a transcendental number, it's a number that never repeats and never ends and goes on and on and on and on. I've lost track. I had a story a couple of about a month or so ago on my link page. That some university had calculated pi to something ridiculous like the 16 trillionth digit number. But yeah, that's why. You can come very close. You can approximate it, but you cannot get it exact.
So in other words, you cannot get, period, forget squaring, you cannot get the area of a circle exact, because what you have that area, it'd be easy to make a square. Just square root it and make the sides.
Well, that's interesting. Theoretically, I guess you can have a theoretically absolute area. The problem then is your dimensions are going to be transcendental as well.
Right, you're not going to look into an area of exactly 4 or, you know what I'm saying, a perfect square.
No. Someplace you're going to end up with another transcendental number to balance out the transcendental number of pi in the equation, if one of the other numbers is an integer, say.
I heard a lot of noise, so I don't know what William was asking you a question, and you answered it, but all I heard was something about an integer. I'm guessing you were answering William's question, or maybe you guys were doubling.
I don't know. William, were you transmitting recently?
I think I doubled. I was saying that the, I'm sorry. I was saying that the square that would be the area of the circle is going to be the square root of pi times r on each side. But as you point out, that's still transcendental.
Yeah. You can't get around that, unfortunately.
Refresh my memory, Roy. You told me this once. What's the difference between a transcendental number and any old irrational number? I thought all irrational numbers didn't have, you know, decimals that continued forever and didn't repeat, but some are transcendental, some are not, so I forgot the difference.
Gee, it's been so long that I don't even remember. I have to look it up. One sec. Okay, I think the trick with transcendental versus an irrational number is that it cannot be described by a polynomial expression either.
Yeah, that's what it was. I mean, that's what you. I remember now. That's what you said before. It was on the Limark technical net a while back.
Yeah. Unfortunately, if you don't use it, you lose it. So what can I tell you? But yeah, that's the trick. Irrational numbers. Rational numbers, actually, if you think about them, make a lot of sense. But everyone kind of thinks of them as being rational. You know, having in the terms of irrational thought and rational thought. What rational numbers simply mean is they can be defined by a ratio of integers. So, 0.33333 forever is basically one-third. So those are rational numbers. Irrational numbers cannot be written as ratios of integers, but they can be written as polynomial equations. Transcendental numbers are neither rational, nor are they definable by polynomial equations.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, I'll have to meditate on that, because it would be transcendental meditation. But anyway, that's a silly joke. But seriously, I'll have to think about that one.
Yeah, mathematics is fun. Anyone have a favorite transcendental number out there? You know, I mean, pi is pretty much already taken by a lot of people. There's Pi Day and such. But is there anyone out there with any other transcendental numbers that they happen to like?
E, Euler's number, or transcendental, and I'm wondering about something like the square root of 2 probably isn't, but I don't really know.
Yeah, the square root of 2 is just an irrational number, but you're right. Euler's number is another transcendental number. And, it doesn't get as much love as pi does. It confuses some people, and a lot of people, unfortunately, don't even know it exists. But Euler's number is a transcendental number, so that's a good choice.
I'm trying to think of some other ones, but those are the ones that popped up the most in the math classes I took that I can remember.
Yeah. Once again, this is AC2GS. If anyone out there has any questions of a technical nature or science or what have you, what the hell, hit that push-to-talk button, give me your first name and your call sign. Once again, this is AC2GS with the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. If you have any questions or comments or topics for tonight, hit that push-to-talk button. Give me your first name and your call sign.
K2JVX, Lloyd.
Oh, hello, Lloyd. How are you? You back in New York?
Affirmative. But it's been very harrowing time work-wise, trying to get it going. Things are very slow, very sluggish. It's just difficult. Sorry I haven't been participating much. I hope to soon. I have a question. Here's a good question. Do you think the club will be resuming in-person meetings in this year?
Well, that's a good question. I wish I had a good answer. We do plan to meet in IS 35, I think it is. There was some talk of it occurring in September, but I don't think the way that Selvin said, even if he gets the okay in a day or two before September 1st, he'll have the meeting there, and people who want to can just zoom in with a web connection. I don't think the school's going to be ready for us September, maybe not even October. Unfortunately, the Delta variant and the fluctuations and the return of mask requirements, I think, has kind of put a fix in. Hopefully, maybe we'll be able to have it for our December party. I guess I'm just being a pessimist, but I think at least for the next few months that it's unlikely that a school is going to let a bunch of guys just kind of hang out there.
After that, K2JVX, at Moderna and have gotten the variant. And I have to say the symptoms were very mild. They thought they had a cold, but nonetheless, they definitely tested positive. It's really thrown a wrench in the works, And all this could be improved, at least from my ham standpoint, if the new cycle was coming too, which just seems to be really sluggish too. What's your opinion on that, over?
You're alluding to the sunspot cycle?
Affirmative.
Well, what can I tell you? The sunspot cycle will come at its own pace. It's not going to peak for another 4 years, and usually they're not perfectly symmetrical. The trip to the peak is not identical to the trip to the valley. So there's still time to go. I think I kind of look at the glasses half full when 10 meters is actually pretty much open. The last month has been a terrible disappointment for anyone operating on 10 meters. But these are the vagaries of sunspots are not something highly dependable on a day in, a week in, a week out. I am generally optimistic. There were people who were terribly pessimistic. I still remember a gentleman from a few years ago. He lived in New Jersey. He was of an age, and he told me that he doesn't think that this sunspot cycle is going to be terribly good. It's going to fizzle out because there were a lot of naysayers and pessimists a few years ago. And he said, you know, that this was going to be his last hurrah. After that, chances are he wouldn't really be benefiting from any future sunspot maximums, which is a shame to kind of look upon the world as. But I still remain optimistic, but you got to give it time.
Yeah, me too. 40 meters has been very bad lately, too, because of the harmonics from the alleged Cuban jamming of Radio Marte, which is just a real bummer, too. So 40 used to be really reliable, but it's a mess. It's just a complete mess. Hello, Bob, by the way. Back to you, Roy.
Yeah, we were discussing that about a month ago on the Limark technical net, and obviously the Cubans are not fessing up, but I think it's an obvious thing. Over time, I figure it's going to be less because they're probably going to go to individual transmitters on the island and remove them physically. Once they get a sense that they've removed most of them, maybe they'll let 40 meters live again.
I hope so, because that is the go-to reliable band and easy to get on for a lot of us, right? 80, difficult, 160, very difficult, plus 80 and 160 are very bad in the summer because of thunderstorm activity, which is, of course, as we also know, been just dreadful also in the last months. So it's just been very kind of difficult and, I have to say, somewhat depressing. So, I'm sorry I haven't been more active just dealing with work and getting by K2JVX in the TechNet.
No problem, Lloyd. As I tell everyone, real life trumps a hobby. Hobby is a means of distracting one and amusing one, and I also say if you're not having fun doing it, you're doing it wrong. But real life takes the precedence, so that's certainly understandable, Lloyd. And, 40 meters is to me the most dependable band for amateur radio operators. It has less seasonal variation and less temporal variation. For the most part, when I tune up my radio on the pan adapters, the band with the most activity, no matter what time of day, tends to be 40 meters. 20 meters has not been terribly active other than contest type of times or very, very peculiar propagation conditions. But again, that's something that hopefully will change in the next 3, 4, 5 years. And we'll see a lot more activity on 20 and 17 and 15 and 10 and even 6, and we'll be able to tell each other a great deal of fish stories of the fish that we landed from all manner of places. I'm really looking forward to it, since this is really the first time I had an opportunity to operate on 10 and 6 during a maximum. The last time, I didn't have much of an antenna to use.
Your lips to God's ears. Did you fix all your antennas this summer?
Yes, indeed. Thankfully, I have them all up and operating, and every so often I sweep them with my V&A just to be absolutely sure. Although my antenna didn't go down this summer, it developed a severe tilt about 2 months after I had it fixed the last time, and the fan dipole was practically useless. I did a sweep, and there was nothing even vaguely reminiscent of a resonant dipole that came out of that sweep. And I found out afterwards that what had happened probably with the tilt, it put so much stress on the elements of the fan dipole that most of them snapped off. And when I was tuning with my PALSTAR antenna tuner, I was basically tuning up my coax cable.
That's too bad. My antennas have been very stable, though, which is good. And I didn't lose any in any storms. Simple wires, I think, are very robust in that regard. They're so light, they don't accumulate anything. They resist the wind. That's all been good. So listen, I need to run. Just wanted to check in, say hello. I did ask a question. And I'll say 7-3, and hope to see you around sometime. K2JVX, back to the net.
Okay, very good, Lloyd. 73, have a safe week, and I hope we have a chance to talk again soon. And I hope business settles that a little bit and gives you a little bit of a breathing room.
Roger that. I hope so, too. So anyway, my best wishes, and to anyone else on the net, it seems like it's only Bob. Good night, and 73 K2JVX out.
Okay, we have Bob, but we also have William, AC2ZV. Once again, this is AC2GS, and my name is Roy, and this is the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. So if there's anyone out there that we missed that has any questions or topics or comments that they would like to make, please hit that push-to-talk button. Okay, maybe we should actually do the puzzle. We've kind of put the puzzle away for a couple of episodes. It's a relatively simple one, so there's no real tricks. The puzzle is basically in a radio wave that is defined as vertically polarized. The electric component exists either one of three choices. Choice A is in both the vertical and horizontal planes. B is only in the horizontal plane. And C is only in the vertical plane. So if anyone would like to hazard a guess, please hit that push-to-talk button.
NVV, I know the answer, but see if anyone else wants to do it.
Well, Bob, I guess you're our only player tonight.
I'm pretty certain this is the technician license question, and it's C, it's in the vertical plane. I think that's the part they're talking about when they say vertically polarized. I hope I'm not wrong.
Yeah, you are absolutely right. By agreement, we designate the polarization angle by the polarization angle of the electric field, not the magnetic field. Electromagnetic fields are one thing, but because they could be described as linear equations, you can separate the magnetic field from the electric field as an equation and operate on it mathematically. What it amounts to is a simultaneous wave. The electric field operates at a certain a degree, and the magnetic field operates 90 degrees away from that particular field. So they say that it's orthogonal. Orthogonal is just a very fancy way for saying 90 degrees. The phase relationship of the electric and magnetic field is in phase. They're the same. So when the electric phase is maximum, the magnetic phase is maximum. When the electric phase is vertical, the magnetic phase is horizontal. So simple concept, but yeah, the answer ultimately is a vertically oriented electrical field is described as a vertically polarized electromagnetic signal.
So actually, if you took the shape of it, I guess it's shaped like a necklace, if you thought of it as, because it expands in both vertical and horizontal all at the same time, so it's down to almost nothing, or maybe to nothing, and then out to the maximum, so it's like a bunch of pearls or beads on a string or something, as far as the shape. Back to you.
Yes, but the problem is that those beads move, they move at 90 degrees to each other. That also has a name. That's called the pointing vector. That's the vector of propagation of the electromagnetic waves.
I'm not sure what you mean by that. Does that mean that if the electric field is like going away from the antenna, that the magnetic field is coming into or towards the antenna at the same time, or are you talking about a different kind of directionality?
No, they're traveling away. There's basically, if you think in terms of a vertically oriented electric field, you have a horizontally oriented magnetic field, and then you have another one 90 degrees to both of those in the opposite direction of the antenna. That's called the pointing vector. That's the propagation of the entire electromagnetic field. So you have three things that you have dimensionality. One is an electric field, one is a magnetic field, and one is a propagating electromagnetic field going away from the radiating antenna.
Oh, okay, yeah, so that one's just going like an arrow, a vector, that's the XYZ, and that's the one that just goes away from the antenna. The others are like going up, and the other one's going sideways, if you like the layman's terms. But the opposite direction part I don't get between electric and magnetic.
I didn't mean to say opposite. It's 90 degrees. They're all 90 degrees. And as you mentioned, it was kind of X, Y, and Z. So the usual type of way of looking at a Cartesian graph, you could say that a vertical polarized electromagnetic wave has the electric field in the Y direction and the magnetic field in the Z direction, and the pointer vector is going in the X direction.
Okay, yeah, sure. Yeah, I get that, sure. So the pointing vector is the string, and the string's going, of course it's directional, the string isn't, and then the other parts just make the pearls or what have you. Yeah, I get it, sure.
Now, very occasionally, you can find a crazy physics textbook, usually a high school physics textbook, probably someplace in Texas, where it's almost guaranteed. You'll find at least a couple of these, because you can find them on websites, where they'll show that the electric field and the magnetic field are not in phase with each other, that they're out of phase by 90 degrees or orthogonally related. That happens in transformers. That happens in the near field or the reactive field or the transformer field. But electromagnetism in the far field is in phase with each other. So occasionally, if you look at enough physics books from high school, you will find some gap where they screwed up the phase relationships of the electric and magnetic field and electromagnetic waves propagating.
Very close to the source, I guess. So then it looks like a twisted ribbon.
Well, it has to do with Maxwell's theory. If you ever studied Maxwell's theory, electric field changes propagate magnetic field changes, which propagate electric field, which propagate magnetic field. So an electric current propagating magnetism, which goes off into being electromagnetism, isn't that hard to conceive, except that temporally the times are off. According to Maxwell's theory, there's a 90-degree difference between the electric and magnetic field magnitudes from inducing these things. That's the problem with near field versus far field. Someplace between the near field and the far field, the phase relationships shift because, among other things, orthogonally phased electromagnetic waves fall off not at the inverse square law, but the inverse cube and 1 over R4, 1 over R5. They collapse rather quickly. So somehow there's a transition point between the near field and the far field where the most, if not all, of the electromagnetic waves phase relationships seem to shift a bit.
So wait, one of them falls off more than the other one, so they get in phase? Is that how it works?
No, the problem is, well, I mean, yeah, there's some kind of transition zone where the phase shifts change. The ones that don't successfully phase shift are attenuated rather rapidly before you leave the near field distances. That's why near field has that limitation based on wavelength. So the orthogonally phased electromagnetism dissipates, and all you're left with is the in-phase electro and magnetic fields.
So is there a strict definition of the distance of near field? Is it like one wavelength or something like that?
Unfortunately, no. It's a kind of a zone. It's a transition zone. So it's not a binary where you go from one thing to another thing at this exact distance. Usually by time that you get a wavelength away, almost all of the near field effects have dissipated. You might get a little bit of a transient effect, but it's not hard and fast. The spitball rule that most people use is approximately one wavelength distance.
Yeah, I thought I might have read that somewhere. This book that I didn't get, I've been reading it lately, but I started thinking about antenna physics. It looked good, but it was difficult for me. But I might get back to it.
AC2GS. It sort of depends upon the book. If it's college level, you might get away with it. If it's graduate level, it gives me a nosebleed. One of the things that I'm always intrigued by the concept is, if you have a transmitter and if I place a resonant receiving antenna in the near field, the amount of power that comes out of your transmitter changes. You're loading the transmitter by doing that. Whereas if you have your antenna in the far field, whether it's connected or resonant or not resonant, it doesn't load the transmitter. So in that near field, nearby antennas will load your transmitter. It's a curious that's why it acts much more like a transformer than it does a standard antenna receiver transmitter.
So it kind of reflects back or something like that?
Well, it's worse than reflecting back. It's actually pulling out more.
So if you're doing, like, say, 100 watts, it's actually more than 100 watts?
Well, I wouldn't exactly, because you have a limitation in your transmitter, but what will end up happening is your transmitter will be more and more loaded and become more and more inefficient. And so it's not good practice to use your transmitter in the near field.
When you say using it in the near field, you mean the thing that's receiving is less than is like in the near field, like some other antenna or something like that.
Yeah, yeah. In other words, say you have your transmitter locked down. It's set up at a certain gain. You're feeding a certain amplification, a certain voltage, a certain current, whatever. And you're transmitting a signal. Now, if 10 guys a mile away set up antennas and you look at your power output, it doesn't change. On the other hand, if a bunch of people set up a receiving antenna a couple of feet away from your antenna, all of a sudden you're going to get these weird things going on with your transmitter. Your power supply is going to be pulling more current. Your output device is going to try to output more power. If it's structurally designed to put out more than, say, the 100 watts you're putting out, it'll survive it. Otherwise, it'll burn out the final circuits of your transmitter.
Ah, yeah. So if it's a couple feet away, it has to be, that's if the wavelength is more than a couple feet, which I guess most of the bands, except for the higher bands. Anyway, I know what you're saying. Yeah. Don't put two radios next to each other to have one receive the other one's transmission.
Yes, yes. It's very bad practice. Does all kinds of nasty things. Anyway, once again, just in case anyone came late or anyone came up with any questions or thoughts, I am AC2GS. My name is Roy. This is the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. We're here on the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month. Unfortunately, September, we're only going to be here on the fourth Wednesday, the 22nd, because September 8th is the end of Rosh Hashanah, so I won't be around for that one. But if anyone has any questions or comments tonight before we call it a night, please hit that push-to-talk button.
Hi, it's William. I got a comment.
Yeah, sure, William.
I just wanted to mention that when I was doing microwave radio engineering work and we're putting in links all over the place, one of the problems we had was communicating with the tower crews about how to set the antenna polarization.
Okay, in what way?
Well, on a waveguide, the wide side is the H plane and the narrow side is the E plane. And so if you say you want a horizontally polarized signal, they'll put the flat wide side even with the horizon for you. And then the guy at the other end might be smarter, and he'll put it the other way, and then you have a lot of problem trying to bring the link in.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, unfortunately, most amateur radio doesn't really use the waveguides that much. Microwave guys who are kind of bleeding edge, in the old days, they made all their equipment. Nowadays, there's a couple of places. There's a company in Florida that makes microwave equipment. There's a German company that makes expensive, almost commercial microwave equipment. So waveguides, except for, Sunday night, there's one guy who loves to discuss TM modes in waveguides. But other than that, you don't really get much discussion on the amateur bands on waveguides, unfortunately.
I didn't really think so, but the interesting thing about that comment is that we always would have to tell them, okay, for you, it's tower crew horizontal. Just set it up, tower crew horizontal with the wide side equal to the horizon, and we're happy to keep. They'd set it properly for vertical polarization, and so I always chuckle a little bit when I see questions about horizontal and vertical, because it's obvious that from my experience we got it mixed up to be able to communicate better.
Yeah, you can't kind of depend upon that. Again, it's an arbitrary way of describing it. It could have just as easily been that we described the angle polarization of a radiating antenna by the angle of the magnetic field rather than the electric field. It's just someone said, let's call it this, and we went along with it. That's arbitrary, you know, 50% of the time, you know, it doesn't really make a difference. Unfortunately, there are historically in physics times that are real oops moments, you know, especially to this day, you have to draw a current in a way that makes no sense. You're drawing a flow of current in the opposite direction of the free electrons that are going in the opposite way because physicists had a 50-50 chance of getting it right, and they got it wrong, and we're sort of stuck with that. So to this day, you know, youngsters, if they're actually learning about electricity, they have to draw the direction of the current in the opposite direction of the electrons.
I thought we were blaming Ben Franklin for that problem.
Really? I don't think that he's quite the guy who you know, he's an interesting tinkerer. I don't think anyone really classified him as a natural philosopher, you know. I don't recall. I would assume that this was something that got stuck into history around the 1800s. Long after he was gone.
I don't know. I think when he was doing his battery stuff and his lightning stuff, I think that came out of his writing. I'll have to look that up and get back to you on that September 22nd, Roy.
Okay. I mean, if I had to guess, I would guess that back in Benjamin Franklin's time, they had no idea that there were electrons or anything. I think that the concept of one of the very first, I think it was Thomson, who got a Nobel Prize for it, discovered the electron. So until, you know, until that point, everyone was deeply confused of what the heck was going on there.
They had charge, and they were describing charges plus and minus, and somehow it came out backwards.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I mean, they had static charges and such, but okay. I'll have to take a look-see through the literature and try and figure out exactly who gave us that, you know. There's so many other guys. There's Volta. There were a lot of guys working on this for 100-plus years.
No, I just was... I remember Ben Franklin specifically, and I don't know if we could blame the French, though. That would be fun. We might be able to get Lavoisier, so we'll have to bring this up in a month.
Okay, William, it's a date. So once again, this is AC2GS. If anyone has any closing comments for this episode of the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net, please hit that push-to-talk button. Very well. This net has been brought to you by the Kings County Radio Club. Our club is an ARRL-affiliated club based in Brooklyn, New York. We meet on the first Wednesday of each month. Our next meeting will be September 1st, which will be held by teleconference. Club members will be emailed with the details of logging into the meeting. Non-members wishing to join a general club meeting can email me for the required link. Although our meetings informally begin at 7 p.m., our formal regular general meeting starts at 8 p.m. and continues until anywhere from 9 p.m. to 10 p.m., depending upon the number of points that are covered. We have a weekly 2-meter net on every Tuesday night at 9 p.m. on this repeater, and a weekly net featuring Yaesu's Fusion Digital Technology every Thursday night at 9 p.m. using Digital Fusion Technology. You can connect to our repeater while in Fusion Digital mode, either directly using Fusion Digital Technology radios or by using a hotspot and utilizing one of the many network gateways that we have available. We have XLX servers, TGIF gateways, all manner of things. And we also offer an audio stream of the FusionNet on the Internet, as well as all audio transmissions of our club repeater at stream.kc2rc.com. This technical net meets on the second and fourth Wednesdays of each month at 9 p.m. We also sponsor a 10-meter net every Sunday morning at 11 a.m. on 28.380 upper sideband. Members as well as non-members are welcome to participate, although we do appreciate it when our fellow hams join our club. And as always, an application is readily available on our club's website. If you would like to contact the host of the technical net, simply address your email to tech@kc2rc.com. We maintain an active website at www.kingscountyradioclub.com or www.kc2rc.com, which offers archives of this technical net, amateur radio news, original articles, and technical forums. Please visit our website and participate. Our website services were generously donated by the local Brooklyn-based web hosting company, Three Aliens Web Hosting, who we would like to thank. As the great philosopher Jimi Hendrix once said, knowledge speaks, but wisdom listens. So try to listen a bit more and talk a bit less. So we're going to roll this all up and shut it all down, but we'll be back here September 22nd, and you're all welcome to join us. Thanks to all the people that participated tonight, and especially my co-host, Bob KD2NVB. Without you guys, I would just be talking to myself. So this is Roy AC2GS, and I'll be going clear and getting the heck out of here. Everyone be safe, be smart, and we'll talk again real soon. This is AC2GS clear.